Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Radio Northwest Network. Yep, we're the network that serves the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And we always create what we call the best conversation in talk journalism. And you're invited to take part. You can dial in at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you disagree with something you've heard from me or on the show, you go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com and vote in our poll on X. Would you buy a home in a neighborhood where your HOA tracks every car that is coming and going from that neighborhood? Well, the Flock cameras have been controversial, and they're not the only company that does these kinds of cameras. There are about a dozen companies that do this kind of thing. Flock just happens to be the one that gets mentioned the most. And Flock has been controversial. And why? Because they take pictures in a public place and they track license plates using a camera and automated license plate readers, and they have solved an awful lot of crimes. Well, now, homeowners associations, and I have to admit, I have a personal bias against HOAs. Have Tina and I lived in places where we were in an HOA? Yes. Do we live in an HOA today? No. Would we ever buy another house in an HOA? No, we would not. But I'm not that big a fan of HOAs. Some people like them, some people don't. Everybody has the choice to either be in one or not be in one. And I've heard plenty of people saying, no, I was forced to be in an HOA. Nobody forces you to live in a particular house. And if a neighborhood happens to be in an HOA, then that's the choice of the neighborhood. I like the fact that I live in a neighborhood today that gave up its HOA years and years ago. Well, homeowners associations around America are now signing up for Flock safety license plate cameras. And the backlash they're getting now is blowing up some of the home sales. It's killing signed contracts, and some cities are actually landing in court. All of this according to the New York Post. The problem I have is not with the security cameras, it's with the Flock system directly. Anybody and their mother can have easy access to the database. That is what one resident of an HOA says. So I wanted to make today's poll question, would you buy a home in a neighborhood where the HOA uses license plate cameras to track every car coming and going? I know there are pluses to it, there are minuses to it, and they're only taking pictures in places where you have absolutely no expectation of privacy. So you can't argue that the cameras are invading your privacy if what they are shooting is a picture of public places. And if it happens to be a neighborhood and it's the action of an HOA, then the folks who are members of the HOA had to approve that, and they can always disapprove it if they choose to. Would you buy such a home? My answer would be I wouldn't buy in an HOA to begin with, but if I was in an HOA, would I care whether they tracked cars coming and going to try to cut down on burglaries and violent crimes? I'd love to see that happen. Today's poll can be found at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I wanted to mention this first, and it's about the tree huggers who plan to go to court to try to forbid grazing on millions and millions of publicly owned acres of grasslands around the western United States. Now, what seems especially insane about this, we've just spent the last couple of months breathing a lot of smoke in the Pacific Northwest, and it seems likely, unless the fire season ends earlier than it usually does, we are likely to breathe more of that smoke. And where does it come from? It comes from fires that are absolutely unnecessary. And one of the ways you can reduce the likelihood of those fires is to allow cattle grazing on about 24 million publicly owned, federally owned acres across the western United States. And now you've got these tree hugger groups like the Center for Biological Diversity, Noah Greenwald, who filed the lawsuit to stop the plan from moving forward. He filed that last Thursday in U.S. District Court in Portland. It names the Department of Agriculture, the Secretary of Agriculture, Doug Burgum. It names Brooke Rollins, head of USDA. Lawyers for the Center for Biological Diversity say that all of these federal officials are violating federal laws. Do you know what they're doing? They're saying that the West is better off if it burns, and they want to see it burn rather than take all that tall grass and let the cattle graze it down. Now, who does that benefit? It benefits the cattle ranchers. It benefits all the people who work in that industry. It benefits all of us who like steaks and hamburgers. It benefits the public lands by reducing the amount of fuel on the public lands so you're not as likely to get fires. And if you do get those fires, they will not burn as much because you've cut off the fuel supply. Except what are they going to do? They're going to go to court and they're going to try to have the judges run the United States of America. And we've had too much of that already. At least that's my point of view. When you've got elected officials whose job it is to run the United States of America, in the case of federal lands, they are in the hands of the federal government. I've already stated my opinion. I think the federal government should own a lot less land than it does. The United States federal government owns a third of all the land in the United States of America. It's ridiculous. There's nothing in the Constitution that justifies it. But that is an argument for another day. Now that they do own the land, is it their job to manage it to the best advantage of the American public? And the answer is yes. And does the best advantage come with allowing all that land to catch fire by having too much fuel loaded up on it instead of using it to feed livestock? I would think the best benefit for the public would be make sure the fuel loads are small, make sure the fires are infrequent and quickly put out, and make sure that America's beef industry stays one of the best in the entire world. Except the environmentalists don't like that idea. They would rather see it burn. Burn, baby, burn seems to be their mantra. In any case, glad to be with you on a Thursday. We always call this Conspiracy Theory Thursday. So if you've got a favorite conspiracy theory, mine for today is all these tree hugger groups out there saying we'd rather have the West catch on fire, burn, and the rest of the public have to breathe the smoke than do something that actually solves the problem. That's my conspiracy theory. Our poll on X, would you buy a home in a neighborhood where the HOA tracks every car coming and going with closed circuit cameras? You want to jump in to the best conversation in talk journalism? It's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you go right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. You can vote in that poll on X. And coming up in a moment, the Northwest nonsense. And maybe there is some hope for the judicial system in the Pacific Northwest. There's a jury verdict or two that I want to talk about, because I think they send a very important message about where we're going and about whether or not common sense can still actually have its way. We'll talk about all that, and we'll get to the Daily Grill. I also want to mention, in Seattle, something strange is going down at the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, the Seattle Times. They've decided to part company with one of their sports columnists who apparently doesn't like the idea of biological men playing against women. I'm on his side, and he's decided he's packing up and leaving the Fish Wrapper behind. We'll get to that in a moment. You got the Lars Larsen Show. Thinking about selling.
Peace. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larsen Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, I got a question for you. Did we see a glimmer of hope in a jury's decision this week in a very strange Multnomah County lawsuit? I certainly hope so. The suit came from a burglar, believe it or not, who broke into a man's business in the dead of night about 3 years ago. The criminal, Kenneth Voiles, claimed he was only looking for a place to get food and warm up. Strangely, Voiles chose a business to break into that makes stone countertops. Not exactly the first place I'd go looking for food if I was that hungry. Voiles was carrying a bag of stolen tools when he ran into the 70-year-old business owner who had been sleeping in the back office of the business. Ironically, the same city, Portland, that allows thousands of illegal campers on its streets and parks had threatened Mr. Voiles. Voiles, telling him that sleeping in his own business is illegal. Did I mention the burglar also had methamphetamine in his system? The burglar threatened the owner with a pair of bolt cutters, so James Grant, the owner, shot the intruder 3 times but did not kill him. No good deed goes unpunished, though, so Voiles filed a $10 million lawsuit against Grant, the owner of the business. This week, a jury awarded exactly $0 to the criminal plaintiff looking for his multi-million dollar payday. Maybe there's a chance for Portland after all. Most of the elected officials may be dumb as a bag of hammers, but if a jury of average citizens can actually see common sense like that, then maybe we have some hope. Glad to get your calls. We'll get to those in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's really causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Hello, Lars. My name is Adrian. I'm reaching out regarding a $40,000 fraud on my business account with the Bank of America. They made a virtual card on my account and went on a shopping spree from Washington and Vancouver all the way to California. All different stores like Home Depot and Lowe's, Target and Walmart, all the purchases were about $500. The very first purchase they made the bank notice something going on in my account, but they didn't stop it for 9 days, and I ended up almost 40 grand out of my account, and the bank denied me. I don't know where to go. Maybe you have some ideas. I'm actually going to appeal for ideas. I don't know that there is a great solution to that. You would hope that if you have a credit card, your credit card company would keep really close track. And if the bank noticed a problem on the very first purchase, it seems strange that they didn't reach out to the cardholder and say, is this actually you charging on your charge card? And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, our daily grill today is going to go to Aaron Mitchell. Aaron Mitchell is the owner of the cannabis line called LaModa. Now, you might remember over the last several years, we've talked about LaModa a lot. LaModa was the toast of the town. They were opening up pot shops everywhere. I don't particularly like pot, but okay, it's legal in the state of Oregon. Then they began giving bags and bags of cash to Democrat politicians in Salem, including she was for a time Secretary of State Shamia Fagan, got bags of cash, and she got paid a lot more money by LaModa than she was getting paid to be Secretary of State, so she ended up having to resign. Well, now Aaron Mitchell has had almost $8 million in tax liens issued against him by the state of Oregon. That's a lot. I mean, to be able to owe $8 million in taxes, you'd have to gross something like $80 million in sales. And you're in a state-regulated business. How is it that all this business and this non-payment of taxes went right by the state regulators? Is it because they're Democrats, or is it because they were getting bags of cash? Shame on them, and shame on Aaron Mitchell. I wonder if they're going to be able to squeeze him for the millions of dollars he owes. He apparently has unpaid balances in marijuana taxes, personal income, withholding taxes, as well as $8 million to the state of Oregon. I think he also owes some money to the federal government as well. And it sounds like the Democrats will no longer be getting big bags of cash. Glad to be with you on a Thursday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. My favorite post on X today is this one. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has had enough of the so-called reporters who are carrying water for Democrats who claim the American people are being screwed by the tariff refunds. He just set the record straight. If I hear another Democrat lawmaker make the inane remark that the American people should get the money, the American people had the money in the U.S. Treasury. We were forced to give it back. He's right. Blame the Supreme Court of the United States for a ruling that didn't just affect future tariffs, but forced the repayment of billions of dollars the federal government had already collected. And my favorite post on social media, yeah, this is it. For all of those of you like me who've been wondering where exactly is the war and the conflict with Iran going, they now say it's official. Iran is slowly realizing that President Trump and the U.S. military are succeeding in covertly sneaking oil through the Strait of Hormuz to the tune of 10 million barrels a day. Some nights they hit 15 to 20 million. That is the level of pre-war flows through the Strait of Hormuz. CNN even had to admit Iran is losing its grip. Quote, the U.S. is quietly breaking Iran's grip on the Strait of Hormuz. American forces reportedly are protecting tankers, moving about 10 million barrels of oil every day through that waterway. As President Trump opens up another front threatening economic D-Day for the countries that helped Tehran stay afloat, Iran is going to have nothing left. The mullahs asked for all of this. And I think they're absolutely right. So, if you've been wondering where it's going, it appears that Iran slowly but surely is being worn down by Donald Trump's war against Iran. And at some point, they're going to have to admit we're going to have to give up on trying to build nuclear weapons. And that will be a good thing. Every American president has talked about stopping Iran. Only Donald Trump actually did it. Coming up in a moment, clean up Seattle's drug needles. And the state of Washington comes after you with an investigation? Is that safety enforcement or is it government insanity? We're going to talk about that with the founder and executive director of We Heart Seattle coming up next. You're listening to Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news traffic. Have something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. So what happened when an organization cleans up the problem of dirty needles in a city like Seattle, and then the state of Washington comes after you to investigate you because you did the cleanup? I thought we'd ask Andrea Suarez, who's founder and executive director of We Heart Seattle, which I have to admit I'm biased in favor of We Heart Seattle because I like the work they do, but I've got no other connection to them. Andrea, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Lars. Thank you.
Have I characterized that correctly? You're out there doing really good, important work, like picking up used, dirty hypodermic needles that might well stick somebody, even a child, might well get somebody sick with hepatitis or AIDS or other things. And then the state of Washington came after you. What happened?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We've been picking up needles and drug paraphernalia for 6 years, including 2 million pounds of other debris left behind by homeless drug addicts. We self-elected ourselves, myself, to do it as a volunteer for 3 years, left corporate America, and I am the one and only employee of We Heart Seattle, a private-funded nonprofit. And the rest are volunteers predominantly, and we got reported by somebody who said, we've been improperly picking up dirty needles in our parks and playgrounds. So quite a bit of hypocrisy really overall.
Okay, but Andrea, tell me this. What is improperly picketing? I mean, I understand. I want all of you people, you know, your volunteers as well as you, the one sole paid employee of We Heart Seattle. I want you to be careful, maybe even wear some gloves or other protective gear, because I don't want you to get sick or, you know, infected from this stuff. But what do they mean improperly picking up? What does that describe?
Well, and that's the alleged claim. And we do, of course, have a comprehensive safety plan, bloodborne pathogen training, hazardous waste training, certifications, all of that. And, I mean, but it's just like, sometimes when people ask me if we recycle, I'm like, man, that ship has sailed. I've picked up thousands and thousands of bottles of water bottles that we also hand out to the homeless that they use as urinals. It's really bizarre. But anyway, we wear gloves, we have pinchers, we have sharps boxes, we do all that. We're not afraid of the audit at all. Let's be clear. We have a safety plan. But it's like anybody with a half a brain would look into my organization and go, oh, this is like a church going out or mutual aid or a pantry who, you know, maybe you make a couple phone calls and go, oh, okay, yeah, you guys are fine. I'm not opposed to being audited, but audit the city, audit Homeless Inc., care for the city employees that walk through open-air drug markets, and everyday citizens that walk into the City of Seattle library over human feces, barf, bloodied gauze, bloodied alcohol pads where people have prepped themselves to inject drugs on public property. It's just hypocritical overall, Lars. And, you know, well, I'm glad it's getting a lot of media attention because it's well-deserved.
Well, I wanted to get attention because, Andrea, you know, when they say, it sounds like what they want is the paperwork. So in other words, it isn't enough that your organization is out there trying to clean up the mess so that some innocent civilian or, you know, I keep thinking, God forbid, a child steps on one of these needles in a public park or a public place or the public library. And they're saying, oh, but do you have your, bloodborne pathogens training log? Do you have your safety-related employee disciplinary records? Do you have your personal protective equipment hazard assessment? Have you done the paperwork before you pick up the dirty needle? That's what they're asking?
That and much, much more. A long list of documents. Again, we've got the basics. Our second chance employer temp agency, Uplift Northwest, was also investigated or being investigated. You know, this is the former millionaires club that put people to work who exiting prison. I mean, these people are like bending over and picking up foil that are, you know, laced with drugs and in our parks. And, you know, I'm not, you know, above any kind of inspection or anything like that, but just be consistent about where the problem really lies. And, you know, let's rise all boats together and go after all these other agencies that have needles in their apartments, in the hallways, in the bathrooms. Our city parks are strewn with this stuff. Like, shut it down or do something about it. And so I just find it just very unfair. And it is weighing us down. You know, it scares away volunteers, potential donors, potential people who think we are doing something dangerous. Now, of course, I've been very public about this, but at the end of the day, you know, we're doing things correctly, and to the city, to the state, go audit your own darn city, county-funded, tax-funded programs that aren't doing their job, and we are. Like, that's the hypocrisy. That's the egregious element of it that, you know, and kids are being sticked with needles. In fact, the same people that, this is the other thing, in case your audience doesn't know, the Department of Health hand out the needles, foils, cookers, tourniquets to drug addicts, temp side in parks and on sidewalks, and they don't do anything to go around and pick it up or tell the drug addicts where to dispose of their drug paraphernalia. Well, of course, they don't have the faculties to do so at all.
I'm talking to Andrea Suarez, who's founder and executive director of We Heart Seattle. That kind of takes us down to, you know, I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but I remember years ago when they first proposed these needle exchanges, and they called them exchanges. They said to get 10 new needles or 50 new needles, you have to bring 50 of your dirty needles back in. And that would have addressed that. But these days, they don't even make a pretense of trying to collect the old needles, do they? They just hand out more, right?
Well, they've changed the name now. They've gotten away from that object. You know, they don't call it the needle exchange anymore. Now it's like the, it's just the public health department door, you know. And it got so bad in 2021, 2022 when we were in the bowels of these urban hiking trails and parks. They ran out of sharps containers for us to even use. We also went down there earlier this week, where are we at? Friday, Thursday. Earlier this week, and asked the Department of Needle Exchange Health people to say, well, what is the proper way to pick up fentanyl foil? Because I don't think you've even actually updated your records. And guess what? They couldn't produce a piece of paper that told an everyday citizen how to pick up a piece of foil, because if you walk out any front door in downtown Seattle and in the neighborhoods of Ballard, Cap Hill, you will see foil stuck to the sidewalk. And they're now handing out paperwork on how to reverse the overdose of your dog. So that's how we're managing the crisis, is just Band-Aid after Band-Aid after Band-Aid, and then coming after me and bogging me down with a bunch of paperwork.
Andrew, before we run out of time, Andrew, tell my audience how they can help you out, financially or otherwise.
Yeah, this is a great time to have support. And by that, I mean donate at weheartseattle.org. It's a safe place to do a credit card donation, mail a check. It's all on there, trade stock. Let's show the community and, you know, the state of Washington that, you know, we're not the bad guy, and I need, you know, gloves, tires, gas, insurance, and all the things. So please donate. It's a tax write-off, and we'll try to fund it so we get stuff done.
Andrea, thank you very much. That's Andrea Suarez, who's founder and executive director of We Heart Seattle. Back in a moment, we'll talk about the kids stuck on the park ride who got $275. If you're losing it,
on the go? Can't listen to Lars live? No problem. Get the podcast 24/7 at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And at some point today, or maybe on First Amendment Friday, I'm going to talk about that Seattle Times sports columnist who's apparently decided to leave. And you say, why would I care if a sports columnist at one of the Daily Dead Fish Wrappers of the Northwest is leaving? Imagine if you're a sports columnist and you're writing for one of the biggest papers in Seattle, probably the biggest paper in the state of Washington, in the 13th biggest city in America, and you've decided to leave because the paper keeps on spiking your columns where you're trying to talk about young ladies who want to play sports but don't want to have to play against biological males who are pretending to be women. And he says he's finally had it up to here. They won't publish his columns, so he's going to leave and go somewhere else. But if that tells you about the editorial stance of the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, the Seattle Times, I think it tells us something disturbing about that. But I want to talk first to Michael Fuller, the underdog lawyer that you've heard on the show before, because he sent me a note this morning. We were both watching some of the he's been handling a case that people have been watching about some young people, kids who were caught on a ride at Oaks Park that malfunctioned and stuck them upside down for about 25 minutes. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars.
I thought I'd also get your take on another case in which a jury actually did something sensible that I mentioned in the commentary today. But let's start with the two teenagers stuck on the Oaks Park ride who got a good jury decision and a good size award, $275,000 each, and this was your case, right?
Correct, and it's a shame that we had to spend 2 years in corporate litigation because the insurance companies denied all liability for two straight years, and then just the week before trial, once they know they're going to face a local jury, they say, oh, I guess we are liable, we are at fault. And to try to basically make the families seem greedy, but yeah, we're very pleased with this verdict.
Yeah, because when I see numbers like $275,000, that's not the usual lawsuit numbers that you see. You're usually seeing people looking for millions of dollars. In this case, what was the case you made to or would have made to the jury as to why your clients were entitled to some kind of compensation after a malfunctioning ride stuck them upside down and maybe believing that they might fall out of that ride and be killed?
So we had the ability to set the cap. And so we set that cap first at, I think, $125,000 when it was first filed. And then we kept increasing it because what we saw was over the last 2 years, unfortunately, these young ladies needed physical therapy. One had ongoing discomfort in her shoulder. They both required counseling. One required anti-anxiety medicine, and it was really affecting their life. They ended up with what doctors say is probably a permanent fear of flying. One of them had to pass on a chance to take an exchange trip to Europe because she was afraid to get on a plane. Fear of elevators, certainly fear of amusement parks. So We had a cap of a million. We didn't ask for any specific number. We really just wanted accountability. And the jury came back. I think the defense had asked at one point for the jury to give like 25,000. And we were, you know, ready to accept whatever the jury thought was fair. But luckily it was enough that I think does adequately compensate these young people.
And I told you I got a kind of a nasty note from a gentleman who wrote in and said, it's unbelievable that a jury would award two children $500,000 for being scared. I mean, they weren't stuck on the ride for hours. It was minutes. I'm sure some blood-sucking piece of human excrement attorney, I think he's referring to you, Michael, contacted them before they even had a chance to think about a lawsuit. There needs to be a law that says if you're going to sue, somebody has to put up a bond to cover all the expenses if you lose. How would you answer that guy?
I think he's entitled to his opinion. You know, I grew up poor and conservative, and I never appreciated lawsuits or payouts or anything like that. These families are actually well off. They don't need anybody's handout. But I can understand his frustration. But what I would let him know is these were 13 and 14-year-old girls on a field trip without their parents. They were held upside down 100 feet above concrete, constantly worrying that those straps were going to release and that they were going to fall to their death. And ultimately, I mean, who can really disagree with a random jury of 12 people from the community? And two of them didn't agree with the verdict. Now, maybe they would have allowed more, but probably they were, we suspect, maybe arguing less. But I just don't think you can really complain when 12 random people from the community make an informed decision. As far as the blood-sucking lawyers, yeah, I was never a big fan of trial lawyers growing up either. But you know, these families reached out to law firms, including Underdog Law Office, but also other law firms in town, because they weren't getting answers from the ride manufacturer or from the CEO of Oaks Park. And I'm a fan of Oaks Park, grew up watching Ramblin' Rod and seeing Oaks Park on there and wishing I could go. So there's no animus towards the park itself, but the families were not getting answers. And so they filed this lawsuit in part so they could find out exactly what happened to their daughters.
And that's not unreasonable. You also commented, because you sent me a note about this other case involving the burglar who wanted $10 million because he got shot by the owner of a business when he broke into the business in the middle of the night, and he didn't know the owner was sleeping there, and the owner got up and was confronted and feared for his life and shot the guy three times but didn't kill him, and so the guy turns around and sues him. What should we make of cases like that and the fact that a jury in that case said, no, we're not giving you a dime?
You know, I'm certainly sympathetic to people who don't have a warm place to sleep at night, but when you break into a building, you do so at your own peril. And so I had actually, you know, I'm not a big fan of insurance companies, but I read about that case like you did. I actually wrote a note to the insurance company lawyer and I said, hey, just so you know, if I was on your jury, I'd rule in your favor. It's helpful when you're in the heat of battle as a lawyer to get a note like that. And so I sent that note last week, and sure enough, it was a defense verdict. But again, I think that person's entitled to their day in court, and if a jury would have allowed money, I think that's what we call fair. But obviously the jury didn't, and it sounds like you wouldn't have, and I wouldn't have either.
No, and part of what bothers me on that is that when this business owner gets sued, his insurance company, I'm hoping, would step forward and pay the expenses, but he's got expenses to pay as well. So he gets sued by a dirtbag who broke into his business and threatened his life and ended up getting shot, and should have been glad that, you know, that the store owner wasn't a better shot. But giving this, you know, sad sack story about, oh, I'm hungry and cold. So you broke into a place that makes stone countertops, you know, granite and marble countertops, and you thought that's the place you were going to find some food? I don't think so. But I'm glad the jury told him no.
Yeah, didn't quite add up.
No, it really didn't. Hey, Michael, you want to tell everybody where to find the Underdog Lawyer?
Yep, underdoglawyer.com.
Very good. That's Michael Fuller. Michael joins us from time to time to talk about the interesting stories he's involved in. This segment of the Lars Larson Show is brought to you by eLegacy. You've spent your whole life building your wealth. Don't leave it unprotected. Set up your kids and grandkids for success the way Tina and I have by creating a customized estate plan with eLegacy. Go to eLegacyLars.com and set up a complimentary consultation. That's eLegacyLars.com.
The Lars Larson Show.
Experience FM News 101.
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. But I've been looking forward to this opportunity to talk to Joel Ryan, who is Executive Director of the Washington State Association of Head Start. And over the years, I've had lots of people give me a hard time because I don't believe that Head Start does kids much good at all. It certainly isn't worth $250 billion that have been spent on it by the taxpayers since it got started back in 1966. But on that note, and with my bias disclosed, Mr. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Lars. Really appreciate it that you're giving me an opportunity to share with your listeners a little bit about Head Starts. I'm really happy to be here. Lars, you're right. I don't get invited by conservative media to talk a lot about Head Start, but you probably know a lot of conservatives do support Head Start. I mean, Head Start is a program that has a lot of bipartisan support. It's something that the Reagan administration supported. The last reauthorization of the Head Start program was actually under George W. So it tends to get a lot of support. So I'm happy to be here. You know, I think a lot of conservatives.
I think there's a reason it's popular, though. And I don't think the reason has anything to do with it actually doing what it's supposed to do. So persuade my audience that it's worth $20,000 per child for early Head Start and $15,000 for pre-K students to be in a program that all the academic studies I've ever been able to find, and they all come out of liberal universities, have said, yeah, it doesn't make much difference. By second or third grade, you can't even tell the difference between a kid that's gone through Head Start and a kid that hasn't. And that seems like a great way of testing, does Head Start do what it's supposed to do? So does it?
Well, so yeah, so let me try to convince you. The first thing I will say is one of the studies that's often cited by people is the impact study. And that has some control group issues with it, so there's some issues with it. But here's what I would say if we're being honest about it. All of these studies definitely show that kids who go through the Head Start program, they are more ready for school. Now, it is true that there are some studies that show that some of those gains fade out. Some of that has to do with the schools that some of those children are going to. The other thing about it is a lot of those studies are based on a program that was from many years ago. The program has improved dramatically since that time with teachers with better credentials. I worked a lot with the Bush administration on literacy development, math development. So we've done a lot over the years to improve the program. The other thing I would say,
but
too...
But no, hold on, Joel, we're drifting off the main question. The question is, if I went to my doctor and my doctor said, Lars, you have this ailment, and I say, okay, how do you treat it? He said, you take this pill. And I said, well, does the pill work? Yeah. And he says, well, when we give the pill to 100 people who have your ailment, and we give them a sugar pill to the other 100 people, the 100 people who got the pill, almost all of them get better. And the ones who get the sugar pill, they don't get better. That would be proof to me that something works. So if you say we put a bunch of kids in Head Start.
Let me just pose something to you.
Sure.
There has been a study that did do that. The study that's frequently cited by people who have concerns about Head Start, actually, so let me give you your example again. The study that actually looked at, and there's a more recent study in 2021, that you get Crestor, the other people in the control group don't get it. They did find positive outcomes for kids going into school and even long-term gains like graduating high school, college. They're not on public benefits when they're adults. The study that's often cited by people who have concerns about Head Start is that somebody got Crestor, but another person got a generic cholesterol medicine for 40% of the control group.
Yeah.
So, of course, so what you're seeing, of course, is that the results aren't terrific, but there's been issues with some of these studies. I mean, for me as an advocate for Head Start, am I a more liberal person? Yes, I am. But I would say this. I've worked with... Yes.
But,
But I've also,
I don't want to burn up all of our time. Yeah. I'm anxious. Yeah. If we're going to spend $250 billion over the last, 50 years doing something, there should be a definable result. That is, you put the kids in Head Start, they do much better in school, not just entering in first grade, but by second or third grade, they're well ahead of the non-Head Start kids. Except that's not what the studies show. The studies show, and I'll skip to where, because we're going to run out of time. But Mr. Ryan, I think the reason this is popular, it's very expensive daycare paid for by somebody else. And that makes it popular with everybody who's got kids who put kids in Head Start. They love it because somebody else is paying the tab for very expensive daycare.
Well, here's a couple of things I would say about. First of all, I think the studies are mixed across the board. I personally think there are much more positive studies for Head Start, demonstrating the investment. I think that the savings, there are some earlier studies that looked at criminal justice savings, which are huge. If you can divert people from getting involved in the juvenile justice system, foster care, kids getting separated, those costs are dramatically more than the cost of Head Start. Plus, the other thing I would say to your viewers is that child care is expensive, especially good child care. So in many cases, for a private pay person, which most of childcare is, it can cost more than going to the University of Washington or Oregon.
Is so most of that, though, because of government regulations? Because when the government comes in and says, oh, you want to do daycare? You need a 4-year degree. You've got to have a bachelor's degree. You've got to have all these credentials. Oh, and you can only take care of so many kids, so we're going to limit all that. By the time you're done with all those requirements, of course it's expensive. The government made it expensive. Right.
Yeah, but it made it expensive because you have to have a certain level of quality. But I will say there's a balance.
Do you think you need a 4-year degree to do daycare?
No. And Head Start doesn't require that. It requires an associate degree. But here's what I would say. One of the things the Trump administration is doing is trying to increase the size of classrooms. I think that's a bad idea. I think that if you ask any parent, a parent is going to want their kid to be in a small classroom with a limited number of kids per teacher. One of the things the Trump administration is proposing to do is to make that class size bigger. Now, it might be okay in Oregon and Washington, sort of our area. Mississippi, you could have 11 kids, 11 2-year-olds for one teacher. Some of those places.
Do you know which one does better with education, Mississippi or Oregon? Take a guess.
Again, it's more of your definition.
It ain't Oregon. Mr. Ryan, you know that Oregon sucks compared to Mississippi, don't you?
This is what I would say. We're going to disagree on this, but I would say the level of poverty in the state of Mississippi is substantially greater than it is in Oregon.
Then why is Mississippi producing tremendous education gains? And is at the top of the pile nationwide, and Oregon is at the bottom of the pile. I'll tell you what, I want to hold Joel Ryan through. Will you do another segment with me?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, let's get going.
We'll be back. I'm with Joel Ryan. Joel is the executive director of the Washington State Association of Head Start. You've got the Lars Larson Show. To vision. If you
local, national, Lars has you covered. Call him from anywhere. 866 Hey Lars. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We've been talking about Head Start, and since I always believe in disclosing if I have a dog in the fight, I don't make a dime by saying that I don't believe that Head Start works or that it's worth the money that we have wasted on it, $250 billion over the last 50 years or so. But I don't make any money from it. And in fact, if anything, I get myself hated by certain people, parents especially, because I don't like the program. And they say, oh, but we love Head Start. And I say, yeah, it's because you're getting free daycare out of it. Joel Ryan does make his living from Head Start. He's the executive director of the Washington State Association of Head Start. What is that, Mr. Ryan?
I said, thanks for the intro, Lars.
Well, I'm really
appreciative that you're giving me the opportunity to be here, even if we don't agree on some of these issues. So just know that. I do appreciate it.
Well, let's talk about Mississippi. You brought up Mississippi, and you pointed out Mississippi mm-hmm. has an incredible level of poverty. Oregon and Washington, not so much. Very prosperous, mostly college-educated states and all that. And yet Mississippi yep. knocks it out of the park on education, especially in the last dozen years. Oregon and Washington suck. They're at the bottom of the barrel. They're nearly the bottom of the 50 states, 58 if you're an Obama voter, but 50 states for the rest of us. And so... That I don't think that aids your argument, does it?
Well, let me talk about Mississippi let me talk about some things to think about. One of the things is there actually was a study on Head Start programs in Mississippi that showed it was I think it was either Ole Miss that did the study, but they actually did a really great study of the Head Start grantees in the state of Mississippi that really did show positive gains through the schools. The other thing I'll say that kind of in terms of our conversation about the K-12 system is there was a research study by a guy named David Demings that looked at where do these Head Start kids go? And for kids that go to schools that are better resourced, you don't see the fade out. For schools that are less resourced, then you will see some fade out. And some of that has to do with the fact that they have to catch up other kids because those kids haven't had opportunities to have early learning or support at home. But some of it is just their lack of resource. So I'll say this about the schools. It matters where these Head Start kids go. And if they're able to go to good schools, whether it's in Mississippi or out here in the Pacific Northwest, that makes a huge difference. So we were talking earlier about sort of like, you know, you take your medication or I look at this sort of like antibiotics, right? If you take antibiotics for 1 day or 2 days, you might feel better. You might start to be able to go outside or feel better if you had strep throat or something. But if you don't continue your full course, you might be back to square one. And I kind of look at that for Head Start.
There is a full course, and it's called public education K through 12. So Head Start is supposed to come ahead of K-12, of K, the K in K-12. Correct.
Every single study of Head Start shows, no matter what, whether it's issues of fade out or not fade out, every single study of Head Start shows that when the kids arrive at school, they are ready for school and they're well beyond their peers that didn't have a Head Start experience. Now, the question that you've been raising, which is, well, what happens next? Some studies have showed that gains fade out after a few years. Some studies have shown no, they don't fade out.
Is it fair to say most studies show the gains fade out?
No, it's not. There actually are even studies that show long-term benefits because Head Start partners with parents. I mean, here's the thing, you know, and I do talk to a lot of different audiences. One of the things more conservative listeners or viewers are interested in is Head Start is one of the rare federal programs that not only supports parents going to work, of course, all that stuff, but it also gives parents decision-making power. They choose the teachers. They choose the curriculum. They choose where the sites are. I don't know a federal program that does that. So that's really unique about the Head Start program, where they really partner
with
parents.
I'm not sure that's a good thing. Are you sure that's a good thing? Because if you said, Lars, you get to choose the teacher, how do I have any expertise? Does the average parent have any expertise in choosing who's going to teach Head Start?
Being a parent at least allows you to have a say in what's in the best interest of your child. It doesn't mean you're the only person who's making that decision, but it's one of the rare federal programs where parents truly have a say. And that makes it unique in terms of federal funding. Of course, I think a lot of your listeners are going to be interested in making sure people can work. I mean, I see Head Start as a real, not just pro-family, but pro-work program. Because it's giving people an opportunity so they can go get a job. And, you know, you and I might not agree on the research, and
anybody daycare that they don't have to pay for, of course, is going to make them more able to take a job. Let me ask you a question that came in. Jim wrote in, and he said, Did that gentleman just say that Head Start helps keep kids out of foster care? Foster care is when you don't have parents, not exactly a choice. Maybe you can explain. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. There was actually a study out in Ohio that specifically talked about the Early Head Start program. And the Early Head Start program, for your listeners, is 0 to up to the age of 3. And what they've been able to find with Early Head Start is that it's able to reduce the level of stress in a household after a mom gives birth, or dad is there with. And that ability to reduce the stress in the household has reduced the number of kids that end up in child maltreatment cases, neglect cases, and ultimately even having to go into foster care, having kids taken away. So the Early Head Start program, although you, as you pointed out, it is expensive, the savings, because of many of the families that we're supporting in Early Head Start, kids that are experiencing homelessness, kids that have a lot of complex issues, these little children, because it's so stressful time, there is research on Early Head Start from Ohio that actually demonstrates that those children are much less likely to end up in foster care as a result of being in Early Head Start, which is a huge saving. If you have to go into the foster care system, it is expensive for everybody.
Last quick question. Could we agree that everything that's taught in Head Start could be taught by parents?
I think it can be taught with the parents. And that's the beauty of Head Start.
So you're saying that parents are not capable of teaching the things that kids learn in Head Start? Numbers, colors,
reading. I'm not saying that at all. This is what I'm saying is that parents volunteer in Head Start. Parents are there to help decide curriculum.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather station. Follow the Lars Larson Show on X at Lars Larson Show. You never know what he'll post. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. There's this kind of interesting dichotomy that goes on. Sometimes the FBI seems to be all over certain subjects, and then there are other times where it takes months and months and months for the FBI to get anything done. For example, a pro-life clinic gets firebombed, but the FBI takes months to actually come up with even the surveillance footage of what was going on. Is the federal government deliberately looking the other way when political violence targets conservatives? I thought we'd put that question to Scott Wheeler, who's an acclaimed investigative reporter, national security expert, and a U.S. Army veteran. Mr. Wheeler, welcome to the program, and thanks for your service in uniform. Tell me what we should make of all this.
Well, this had started back right after the Dobbs decision leaked from the Supreme Court. There were hundreds of attacks on pro-life clinics and, in some cases, churches. And this was, in this particular case, it was a clinic up in Buffalo, the Compass Care Clinic. It was firebombed, over $500,000 worth of damage. Their security video picked up the vehicle pulling in, the suspects getting out, launching the Molotov cocktails into the windows, and driving away. And this was over four years ago. And we came in and investigated it. The FBI seemed not interested at all in solving it. So we worked it for 3.5 years and finally found, about 6 months ago, we found the suspects. I did a report on it. I actually confronted the suspects, and all that's recorded on video. You can see it at scottwheeler.substack.com for free, and please spread the word. But the FBI still, they have not contacted me to ask for how to find the suspects or anything else. And so I think this is part of the Democrat Party's, they've been infiltrating the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Justice, and taking over the rank and file positions with their cronies. And that way they don't get investigated. And when their allies, or in the case of this case, it was Antifa And that's the Democrat Party's militia sometimes.
Yep. They're brown shirts.
They don't get, they don't get investigated.
Well, and Mr. Wheeler, it would actually make a lot of things make sense, like why, you know, there are various federal agencies that show almost no interest when it comes to, say, conservative causes, but when it comes to something involving liberals or a liberal cause, then they will unleash the entire, you know, weight of the agency to go after it. But I have to imagine that within the FBI, there are people who are professionals who believe, look, this is wrong. Our agency should be doing more on this. Are you seeing any evidence of that, or is the entire agency sold out?
Well, not the entire agency. There are good people, and we see that from time to time. During the Biden administration, when it was leaked that the field office in Richmond, Virginia, was going to infiltrate a Catholic church, one of the agents resigned in protest and blew it open. And they, of course, denied that they were doing what they were actually doing. But that's what happens. And so there are good people in there, but oftentimes they're kept from doing the investigations and told to follow orders. And that's where, you know, you probably remember, Lars, 20 years ago, the Democrats hated the CIA. They hated the FBI. They hated the Justice Department. They didn't trust them. Then over time, it started during the Clinton years and accelerated during the Obama years. They started taking over the civil service jobs in there where they have control. Then they have people who will leak when they need it. They'll have people who won't say anything when they're instructed to manufacture an investigation that suggests that a presidential candidate was a tool of a foreign leader, things like that. That's how that has happened. Their people have, you know, they over time they get promoted and they get to the upper ranks, the SES positions, and that's really what runs the Bureau and runs the Department of Justice. These the positions they get that are the E grade up to the executive positions, and that's how you get a Peter Strzok, for example, as head of counterterrorism or counterintelligence for the FBI. This was a Democrat Party crony. He was feckless and incompetent, and he didn't even know, while he was the second in command of the FBI counterintelligence, didn't know that President Obama was caught on a hot mic telling Medvedev to give a message to Putin that he'd be more flexible after his election. Strzok did not know this, and he was the second in command at that time, and was later
was
promoted.
Guy who was having an affair with another FBI agent on company time, and they were exchanging messages about how they needed to have an insurance policy to make sure that Trump didn't get into the White House because they knew it would mean trouble for the agency.
That's the same guy, and he was promoted after that. He was promoted to the head of counterintelligence for the FBI. And during his questioning in a 2017 hearing, a Republican on the committee asked me what questions to ask Strzok. I said one would be, what was his reaction to Obama telling Medvedev to relay a message to Putin that he'd be more flexible after his election? And when they asked him the question, he acted like he didn't know, had no idea. It was the most bizarre thing you could ever imagine.
Yeah, when an American president effectively admits on a hot mic that he is he's exchanging messages out of view of the public, and he's doing it because he's telling, you know, the head of Russia, I'll have more flexibility once I'm reelected, because once I'm reelected, they can't do anything. I'll simply finish out my second term, and that'll be that.
And by the way, James Clapper, Obama's head of Homeland Security, told Congress that Putin was interfering in the 2012 election. So what did Obama know when he sent that message? Was he telling Putin that he'll collaborate with him if he gets reelected? I mean, that's all the things the Democrats claimed about Trump in 2016 was actually true of Obama.
And at this point, is there any chance we can get that agency cleaned out?
I think it could be reformed, but it's going to take, you know, the Democrats are in lockstep with them now because their cronies are in place. And so it'll take an act of Congress to reform it. And right now the will is not there. The Democrats control the narrative even when they're not in power. And Republicans have a hard time getting control. And
I think that Republicans need to grow a backbone. That is Scott Wheeler. Scott, thanks very much. Acclaimed investigative reporter, national security expert, and U.S. Army veteran. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. The parking lot in Doug.
Take a peek inside Lars's studio. Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And, of course, we've talked a bit about Head Start today. I've never made it a secret that I don't think much of the program, and I don't think much of it because every time you look for any kind of study that suggests it actually does any good for all the money it has cost, you find out, it feels good, but that's about it. Doesn't actually make a difference for the kids. Cindy writes in, Lars, the people involved with Head Start will always argue about the added value to the children. The piece they never talk about, it's overfunded. It's necessary to states because it funds the administrative overhead for multiple programs outside of Head Start. If that funding were cut, many organizations would lose their accountants, their fundraisers, their IT pros. Do those people help the Head Start program? Yes, but they also do jobs for multiple programs under the same organizational umbrella, and those organizations would sink without those funds. And then this one from Jim. Lars, your guest keeps talking about all the studies. No wonder it costs $15,000 to $20,000 per child for Head Start. If they cut all those studies, I think the cost would go way down. Probably not. Because the way you figure out what a government program is going to cost, usually 80% of the cost of that program is personnel. So if you have a program like Head Start in which you are forced to use at least people with associate's degrees, many of them have bachelor's degrees, and they can only care for so many kids, then the end result is it's going to be very expensive because take their salaries and figure that's 80% of the budget. Let's go to Diana. Hey, Diana, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, so I 100% agree with you, but your last guest that you had on, I'm a total naysayer. When it comes to Head Start, I really do believe that, like, so you come with a kid that's, like, 3 or 4 years old, you know, you're trying to get them, you know, acclimated to, you know, like sitting in a chair, doing, you know, like standing up, doing stuff like that. So I think that that's the parents' responsibility.
Agreed.
Ahead of time.
Agreed.
To do everything like that. Like, so to me, it's like a glorified babysitter.
Yep.
And then my biggest thing is that, like, so I had my kid in Head Start, and I honestly think that that's just like their standing point because you have like a 3-4-year-old. One day they want to be a cat. The next day they want to be a dog. You know, like, and then they get into Power Rangers, and so they want to be a Power Ranger. You know, like, so that is to them, like, oh, we need to put your kid on Ritalin. You know, like, and so 95% of those kids that go to Head Start, they start out in kindergarten on Ritalin.
And sadly, there are an awful lot of kids in American schools who are on Ritalin. And if you compare to, say, Great Britain, which is culturally similar to the United States, you find out a much smaller percentage of students are on Ritalin at a young age. And I think, Diana, you're absolutely right about that. Let's go to Lynn. Lou, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Yeah, for Conspiracy Theory Thursday, I want to ask your opinion
if there are any leftist organizations that you're aware of who try to censor your show and conservative talk show hosts in general.
Well, sure. I mean, there have been organizations that have gone out and they have tried to persuade, say, advertisers to stop supporting the show. Because when you talk about radio and even when it goes to podcasting and social media, it's all supported by, usually by, advertising messages that are on it. So are there groups that have tried to do that? Yes. Have they done it successfully? The answer is no. I'm still here. But do they try to do that? Sure. And would there be any way for me to stop them from doing that? No, because how would I stop somebody from voicing their opinion to an advertiser saying, we don't like Lars, we don't want you to support him? What they should understand, though, is that for an awful lot of those advertisers who support my programs and have for the last 30-plus years, they understand that when people are paying attention to a program, you're going to get critics like that. And the critics just mean people are actually paying attention. When I run out of critics, Lou, I'll probably run out of audience as well. And I appreciate the call. Let's go to Bill. Hey, Bill, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Well, Lars, I've been thinking about this actually for a long time. And yeah. I'm wondering what the liberals' end game is, because you know, if they win the House and not the Senate, there's a path there, you know, and vice versa. If they win the Senate and not the House, and even if they get the next presidency, Americans are not going to put up with this. I mean, you saw the 18,000 Christian bikers that went to Dearborn, and I looked up on Google how many hunters there are in this country, and it was 15 million.
Yep.
And you know, we're not going to stand for it. I mean, no matter what happens
they're going to whittle us down. They're going to try to whittle us down. And Bill, let me tell you something. There are conservatives who hate socialism until they find out that something that they love gets benefited by a government program. I mean, do you love farmers? I love farmers too. Should we cut farm subsidies? Try to cut farm subsidies and see what farmers say to you. And then you think, but that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to programs. And it's very insidious, because it's like how the heroin dealer, I've never tried heroin myself, but I understand heroin dealers will give away the first couple of doses for free. You know why? Because once they get you hooked, then they've got you. So right. What happens when conservatives say, well, I have this program, I wish somebody would support my program. And they get some government funding for it. And all of a sudden, you own them. You own them lock, stock, and barrel. Go ahead.
I'm talking about, I mean, this could very well come down to a physical battle. And, you know, who's going to come and take the guns out of my hand? You know, I mean, Americans are patriotic, and I can't believe that sheriffs and the police are going to be knocking on doors trying to take people's guns. And, you know, I believe there might be a civil war, depending on what happens.
There might, but I think the liberals intend to do it in a much softer fashion. I think they intend not to do it through a war, but just by slowly creeping in and taking over and compromising you by getting you to get on the government dole. And that's what they're going to do.
The Lars Larson Show.
Hey there, it's
FM News 101.
8 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson.
Secure the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And
Lars.
Now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I didn't know a few weeks ago when we talked to James Casper, the man who had such high hopes and some big plans for what is now a blown-up building. I had no idea that it was going to work out that way. The Centennial Mills building is now virtually destroyed. The last remaining pieces of it will be knocked down. This is a building that the city of Portland, the government of Portland, spent millions of dollars to buy and then sold it a couple of years ago for a fraction of that amount. And now the property has been literally blown up. And I thought we'd check back in with James Casper. Mr. Casper, welcome back. I had hoped that that it would be your next visit to the show would be under better circumstances than this, but good to have you back anyway.
Thank you, Lars.
So what did you make of the fact that you kind of predicted this in a way, because and I don't want to overstate it, so haul me back if I go too far. You had big plans to make the Centennial Mills building, over 100 years old, a successful and prosperous business that would bring jobs and economic activity and a lot of fun for people to come down and go to a first-class nightclub and a restaurant and everything else. And the city of Portland fought you every step of the way. And you effectively said, then fine, if you're going to fight me on it, I'm going to walk away after a couple of years of effort. And not long after that, the building burns down, I'm guessing probably because of a fire started by homeless squatters inside a building that would not have been occupied by squatters if the city had actually helped you get that development going. Tell me if I've gone too far on that. Okay.
You hit it right on the head. It was a flight to nowhere, man, I tell you.
What this I just this frustrates me so much, because very infrequently do we run into a story where it is so clear cut that if the city had not fought you every step of the way and said, every time you solve one problem we've put in front of you, we're going to put up another barrier to keep you from doing something with that old building that the city had a multi-million dollar interest in. I mean, what was it, 2000? They paid about $8 million for it, sat on it for a quarter of a century, and sold it at a fire sale for $1 million. I mean, does it get crazier than that?
No, but that's many buildings. I've looked at many buildings in Portland, and I'm from the West Hills, and I love Portland, and I love the Northwest. And you got guys like me that want to refurbish them, not tear them down. I don't want to do anything illegal. I did that with the old Value Motel in Hazeldale. Turned it into a Casper recovery housing for women getting out of prison, jail, or treatment, or men. And it was all homeless camps. Another place out in Orchards in Vancouver, same thing. Turned it into a prosperous, running, good, beautiful building. I mean, I want to do everything legal, but it's like every permit activates another permit. Then they want me to spend $35 million on a garage with a rooftop office / storage / housing dwelling on top. I mean, most people don't have $35 million to build a parking garage next to a building. I'm looking to refurbish it, throw some good money at it. I had the Lundquists, which are awesome people to work with. We had a great deal. We had all the TI work there going to be done, beautiful kitchen, outside seating with the covered. I mean, I like restoring old buildings, and that built. And then I wanted to bring down the water tower that's now on the bottom of the building. I wanted to have that all. I own a blasting and paint company, so I was going to refurbish that, make it into part of the bar. Then they tell you that I can't build a parking lot out there, and I have to come 50 feet off the seawall. And then I can't use the bottom part of the structure, which is another 20,000 square feet, because I wanted a dual-purpose nightclub. I wanted to showcase, like, my favorite bands on the whole planet, which are Alice in Chains and Soundgarden and Nirvana, and bring the young talent that's the new Ozzy Osbournes and the new Motley Crues and the new Teslas and Sublimes into the Northwest and give them a place to jam. And then the top part was going to be my goth, dark, techno. I mean, it is what it is. The Berghain is the number one club on the planet, and I wanted to bring that to the U.S. and make our town, our state, our Portland, Oregon, into a world-class, classy, badass, security, food, good everything. I know what I want, and I do this a lot. So, but I keep getting restrictions and flights to nowhere with Portland, and I love Portland, but I'm the type of guy
I want to hear from you, though. If the city had said, let's make this happen, we're going to help James Casper make it happen, would the building have caught fire? Would the building have been forced to be blown up on Monday?
No. No, because I immediately get my security crew over there. We start building. We start putting the fences up. We start, I mean, I've had, I. There's no way. I mean, I've done this many times on homeless camps, and I don't have anything against the homeless. That's a whole other story. But you're not going to cater in Portland to the homeless over the people that have businesses that want to people give people jobs. I don't understand why everybody wants to tax people that have money because we're the ones giving people jobs.
Okay, so James Casper, do you see any indication that the city of Portland has learned anything from what they've just gone through with you and this building and the fire and the subsequent explosion on Monday?
You just seen on the news yesterday on, I love all the news stations in our town, KGW 2, Channel 2, 12, and they were just talking about $700,000 or $800,000, that, and they said there's many more of exploiting the taxpayer money and not using it the right way, and they don't know where it ever goes. And there's plenty of money to refurbish our old buildings. There's plenty of money to help the homeless. There's plenty of money if they don't budget it right. It's like, shit, I'm about ready to run for mayor. I remember Bud Clark. I used to bartend at downtown on McCall's on the waterfront. I used to love going on Northwest 23rd. I mean, Portland was Portland and Seattle was Seattle, and I love music. I still go down the Roseland. Portland isn't the same as when I was growing up or when my mom and dad was growing up or when my grandma and grandpas were growing up. You know, so it's like I tried. I wanted to do something in my own town where I was born, but it's just they don't know what their ass from a hole in the ground, man.
That's what it sounds like. That's James Casper. James is the developer and business owner who had planned to take that old building, the building that is now being torn right down to the very foundation, Centennial Mills. So a few months ago, Casper was still trying to develop it. The city of Portland kept throwing up roadblocks when they finally threw up enough that they scared him away, and they said, simply go on down the road. And he said, okay, fine. You don't want me to do it, I won't do it. The building ends up occupied by the homeless. And I would imagine that when they finally get to the DNA stuff they're going to find in the wreckage of that building, they're going to find out that there were dead bodies, that there were people who died in that fire that took the building down. And then the explosion that was required to take the big water tower down on top of the building and the rest of the building basically falling apart. And I'll bet they sit on that property for another decade or so because nothing much is going to happen. Sadly, that's what counts for leadership here in the Pacific Northwest. And until the voters elect different leadership, I think we're going to get the same result over and over again. Back in a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest. Reminder that Columbia.
At the KXL News Desk with your Thursday for.
You need a simple.
This is your home for honestly provocative talk radio. The truth every day. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to ask you this question, and it's not entirely rhetorical. It actually comes from a real case that was in court this week. Your 15-year-old daughter is taking part in sports, in this case, the sport of wrestling. I know, women's wrestling or girls wrestling, because this is high school. And she gets matched up against a biological male, only she doesn't know the person she's wrestling is a biological male, and the parents don't know that this person is a biological male. The teachers and the coaches do know this information, but they decide to keep that information from both the parents and the athlete in question, a 15-year-old girl. Now, what should happen then? Well, there are a bunch of laws on the books that are broken by that kind of situation. There are laws about mandatory reporting. There are laws about sexual assault. And that is the case that the Alliance Defending Freedom attorneys, this is an organization that we follow very, very closely, they have taken this case to court. But I'll get into the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X poll question today. We put up a brand new poll question every day from the news of the day. Would you buy a home in a neighborhood where your homeowners association, your HOA, tracks every car coming and going from the neighborhood? Turns out that those HOAs, and I'm not a fan of HOAs. Have I lived in them before? Yeah, I have. My wife and I both lived in HOAs at various times, and we have determined that we are never going to do that again. I'm not a fan of HOAs. But that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that these days, homeowners associations are quietly signing up for flock safety license plate cameras. Now, those read the license plates on cars that come into neighborhoods, and the HOAs are allowing them to be put up. And what happens is, the HOAs then share the information with who they choose to share it with. It may go to law enforcement. So it may be the local police department. It might be other police departments as well. More than 200 homeowners associations nationwide have signed on with Flock, often funded straight out of resident dues and frequently, and here's the key part, without ever putting it to a vote. So would you buy a home in a neighborhood where the HOA tracks every car coming and going? I would answer no, but then I wouldn't move into an HOA. Yesterday's poll question, should schools pay students up to $100 a week just to show up and obtain perfect attendance at school? 95% of you joined me in a no vote on that yesterday. Only 5% of you voted yes on that particular question. So let me go back to this case involving the young lady who is taking part in wrestling. Her name is Callie Keeler, and her mother's name is Stephanie Brown. And they went to court this week, defended by the attorneys of the Alliance Defending Freedom. And they went to court against officials who had directed this young lady to take the mat against a male wrestler without telling Callie Keeler that she was wrestling a man, a boy. A high school age boy. During the match, the male sexually assaulted Keeler, put his hands where they didn't belong. Brown quickly reported the sexual assault. Now, the mother thought, Stephanie Brown thought, I'll go to the school officials, I'll go to the teachers and the coaches and the staff, and I'll tell them this was a sexual assault and they'll do something about it. Well, Keeler's school principal and athletic coordinator have now been criminally charged by prosecutors for failing to protect her by delaying their reporting of the sexual assault. You know, I know that some of you have a different point of view than I do when it comes to this transgender stuff. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're an adult and you want to dress up in women's clothes and you're a man, or you're a woman and you want to dress up in men's clothes and go by a male name, whatever floats your boat. It's not my business to tell you how to live. But when it comes to children, and when it comes to sexual assaults on children, now we're seeing this come to a head because there are people out there in the LGBTQ movement who believe that they have to go out and mutilate teenage boys and girls to satisfy their group's agenda. The group is the LGBTQ. I mean, the initials keep getting longer and longer as they tag more and more cabooses onto that train. But this 15-year-old girl is sexually assaulted, and the folks in charge of education simply decided, we're not going to stand up and object to this because if we do, the gender police are going to come after us. That's what they effectively decided. So they delayed reporting what was a sexual assault. And here's the way senior counsel Hal Frampton puts it. Our client's story shows the grave harms caused by lying about biology. Washington State's policies not only subjected Callie to an unfair athletic disadvantage, but they also put her at risk of unknowingly wrestling a male unless she leaves the sport that she loves. We're urging the court to hold the state and the school officials accountable and require them to respect parental rights and prioritize girls' safety in sports. You know, I almost can't believe it that about a decade ago, when we first started talking about this issue, it's not that we haven't talked about transgender issues going back decades on this program, but only in about the last 10 years has it come to a real head where you've had people saying, well, you have to let the transgender athletes compete as the gender that they identify with, as a girl, even if they're a biological male, or as a boy, if they're a biological girl. And a lot of us have said, no, you don't have to pretend to not know this. I mean, the way that, say, Ketanji Brown Jackson, the Supreme Court justice, who is, by all accounts, a woman, but sat there during sworn testimony before the United States Senate in her confirmation hearing and claimed that unless she was a biologist, she couldn't actually tell you what a woman is, even though she appears to be a woman. It is that kind of lying about biology that has put us in this spot. And so you have schools that have decided they're going to kowtow to the LGBTQ crowd, and they're going to tell them you get special privileges, and at the expense of these other students, at students like Callie Keeler, who only wanted to take part in an athletic competition that her school sponsors, and that's girls wrestling. Except she wasn't wrestling a girl, she was wrestling a boy, and everybody, all the people involved who were in positions of responsibility, decided to keep that information from her, keep her in the dark, keep her mother in the dark, because they didn't want to run afoul of the LGBTQ. That's wrong, and it needs to change. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and missed the Lars Larson Show today? Find Lars's thoughts and get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Should a felony conviction cost you your Second Amendment rights for life? The DOJ says not necessarily. It's now opening the door for some Americans to get their gun rights back. Now, I may have a bias in this. I do not have a felony conviction of any kind, and I do own several firearms, actually several dozen firearms, and I'm glad to keep on owning them. But I've never had a real problem with denying gun ownership to people who've been convicted of violent crimes or other serious felonies. So I thought we'd talk to Michael Letts about that, who's founder, president, and CEO of Invest USA. Michael, welcome back.
Always a privilege to be with you, Lars. Thank you for the opportunity.
So should the DOJ say, we're going to open the door to getting some individuals their gun ownership rights back despite a felony conviction? I guess without knowing the exact nature of what they're proposing, I would say I think there are certain felons who should never get their gun rights back. Murderers, rapists come to mind immediately, people convicted of terrorism crimes. But I think there are probably other felony crimes, a lot of them so-called white-collar crimes, like passing a bad check, that also qualify as felonies, depending on the state, where I'd say, yeah, that person might get their gun rights back. What should we make of this?
Well, Lars, you hit the nail on the head. I think that's the way the vast majority of law enforcement and the way the vast majority of Americans are going to feel. And I understand exactly what Todd, good guy, good friend, is looking at. You know, this is a constitutional right. And so is there a ability to amend, change, narrow a constitutional right? One could argue no. But let's take a closer look at that, Lars.
Sure.
We have the First Amendment, freedom of speech, do we not?
Yep.
But that
yep.
does not give you the ability to stand in a crowded theater and yell fire. Now, it doesn't.
No.
So there are certain limitations.
No.
That's yep. correct. There are certain limitations on our constitutional rights that we enjoy the constitutional rights. But when it comes to putting others in danger or comes to harming other people, our rights become more defined and more limited in various circumstances. We're in the same situation here. As you pointed out, you know, you're talking about white-collar crimes, guilty of embezzlement or this or that or the other. That's a whole separate matter from somebody taking a weapon or taking the life or raping or harming children. That's a different matter. They impose themselves on others, and I don't believe we should give them the tools to continue to do that. You say, aren't you being a little narrow-minded? No, I don't think so. You make that decision. You make choices, Lars. And those choices have consequences. This is one of the things that we are fighting on the front lines of this war to try to overthrow the U.S. government that we are fighting in this country today, is that we are not holding people accountable. There is a cost for your decision. You have to be held accountable. One of those is if you make a decision to harm and take the life or to drastically alter and damage the life of another, that decision should, the consequence should be long range. And I do not believe you should have that ability to carry a firearm down the road. Because here's the other problem, Lars, that this does. Once you're opening up this can of worms, you're starting to go down a slippery slope. You know, you may be saying, okay, well, we're going to do white collar crime. Remember, I don't have any problem with white collar crime people being able to repossess. But here's the issue. If we do that, then what's the next administration? Say that the party changes. The next administration say you've already set precedent. Let's continue to push that on a little further. Maybe not murderers, but rapists are okay. And then maybe not first-degree murders, maybe voluntary manslaughter is okay. Involuntary manslaughter is okay. Maybe second-degree murder. You see how you just go down that slope and keep pushing the envelope?
Yep.
That's a very perilous situation to be in. And quite frankly, here's my question to the administration. Why? What is causing us to discuss this right now? Now, looky here, folks. If there's nothing else going on in this country, then I'm the first one on the front line. Let's talk about this issue today. But, Lars, we've got people that are held accountable. We've got trillions and trillions of dollars that are being stolen, bribery, you know, et cetera, embezzlement. We have a corrupt judicial system. We have a corrupt legislative system. We have corruption within our executive branch. Are you telling me this is the number one burning issue in America?
No.
I don't think so.
And by the way, one of the things about it is this. If you say, well, what about, say, drug crimes? A lot of people view drug crimes, both possession or use of drugs, as being victimless crimes. I don't agree with that conclusion, but they believe that. So if you say, well, then if somebody's convicted, say, of a drug crime, like possession of a controlled substance or distribution of a controlled substance, is that kind of the kind of thing where you'd like to give these people back their gun rights? I would argue that the people who import drugs into our country, including the most serious ones like fentanyl and heroin and cocaine, that inspires a tremendous amount of violence that goes on in American communities. Chicago has dozens of shootings every weekend, and I guarantee you most of them are about gangs fighting over territory and fighting over drug distribution. So, you know, and I think it'll open us up to that kind of question is, well, then would you let somebody who was convicted of, say, possession of a controlled substance get their gun rights back? I would argue no. Because their connection to a business that brings violence to a lot of American cities.
I would carry it a step further. I agree with you, Lars, but Chris, carry it a step further. It, not only does it bring violence, it brings death. How many hundreds of thousands did we lose last year with fentanyl alone?
Yep.
Somebody's responsible for those deaths.
Yep.
Somebody's responsible. You say, well, it's the person that took it. Yeah, well, you know what? A lot of these people took it and didn't even know it was in there. That's the problem.
And it may be that people who brought, say, fentanyl into their home and then a kid gets exposed to it and the kid ends up overdosing and dying. The kid didn't decide to take drugs. It wasn't his decision. It was the decision of some adult, maybe a dealer, maybe a user, who brought it into that child's home. But the child ends up dead all the same.
No question. You know, I asked this particular aspect of it because I've been in politics too long. I'm probably dangerous by being in politics too long. There's always a financial, usually, incentive that drives issues, okay? So my question is, when I said, first of all, why now? Why are we discussing it? Second of all, who's pushing it? And what is the interest that they have in this particular issue? I'd like to know the answers to those questions. I think it'd be very telling to the American people.
I think it would, because here's the DOJ finalizing a rule that would allow individuals who've been banned from owning guns due to criminal convictions to apply to have their gun rights restored. And by the way, Michael, one of the complicating factors of this proposal is that they say it'll have to be done on a case-by-case basis, which I don't think is a bad idea necessarily, because it means every one of those people will have to say, here's the case I would make for me getting my gun rights back. You know, and that is what I did was a long time ago. I've reformed my behavior, whatever it is. The problem is we've got a court system that's already very, very complicated and very, very tied up and occupied by other cases. I don't think they have time for this kind of nonsense. That's Michael Letts, who's founder, president, and CEO of Invest USA. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Are you?
Lars Larson wants to hear from you, even if you disagree. Naysayers get to cut the line at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. My email of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's really causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. I want to mention something that was written by Representative Dwayne Junker. Now, he's been on this program before, but he wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal. And what he made was the argument that both Oregon and Washington are two of the states that have refused to take part in a brand new program. The program would allow people to make contributions to the Education Freedom Tax Credit Program. You'd get a tax credit back from the federal government. This was passed as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill that passed last year under President Donald Trump. Well, what's happened? All the states can take part as long as the governors decide to opt in. Who hasn't opted in? Well, Governor Tina Kotek has not opted in for Oregon, and Governor Bob Ferguson has not opted in for the state of Washington. So what does Representative Junker say? He says, I wrote in today's Wall Street Journal, states refusing to step up to the plate on federal tax credit scholarships will leave their students behind. Oregon is fast becoming that cautionary tale. Despite the nation's report card placing Oregon last in fourth grade reading and math, Governor Tina Kotek announced in June that she will not opt Oregon into the Federal Education Freedom Tax Credit Program. Last November, Representative Junker writes, I joined fellow lawmakers in urging Governor Kotek to participate. The program requires zero new state taxes. It simply allows people to claim a federal tax credit of up to $1,700 for donations to scholarship organizations that funds, and the funds would cover private school tuition, tutoring, special needs services, and vital support for public school students. Oregon must open the doors for its struggling students, not slam them shut, writes Representative Junker. During the 27th legislative session, I will introduce statutory legislation to bypass this executive roadblock and formally opt our state in. You know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see the people in my old business. When I was both a television reporter and a radio reporter, it was always great to be able to go to somebody in a position of power, like a governor, like Tina Kotek, like Bob Ferguson, and say to them, there is this program. It does not cost your state a dime. It gives you a federal tax credit if you make donations, and the money goes to fund school choice. Why won't you opt the state in? And just, you know, I used to love to ask politicians questions that they didn't want to answer, because then you could just keep pressing the question until they finally gave you an answer. Do you think the people of Oregon and Washington have a right to know if the governor has decided not to opt the state into that program? Give a reason why. And if the reason makes sense, that's fair. I don't think there is a good reason not to opt either Oregon or Washington into the program, but afford them the opportunity to offer an explanation of what they're doing. And if their explanation sounds like the purest hogwash, which is probably what it'll be, then Tina Kotek can take the punishment for that in the polls in November. Let's go to Phil. Hey, Phil, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Hey, I was just wondering if you've heard about this Tunnels to Tower program that is now traveling over almost 11,000 miles throughout the United States with a big old piece of the a beam on a flatbed trailer.
I have. Yeah.
Okay. I've been looking. I've been trying to look up the route to see kind of, you know, to like intercept it and check it out. And
I think all you have to do is go tunnels to towers and do a quick. I can do that. Or I can do a quick search like that right now. I guarantee you they're going to have they're going to have a list of where the various stops are going to be.
Yeah, because, yeah, your producer didn't hear anything about it, and ironically enough, the week prior to our encounter, my wife was in that tower in a business meeting, and wow. She was on the top floor in the restaurant.
Wow!
And it's a great organization.
Well, I think all you have to do, and I just did the search myself, you can find out where that exhibit is going to be, and you're right about the artifact that it has, that piece of steel beam that came from the wreckage of the Twin Towers that were blown up by terrorists on 9/11. But it's easy enough to get the information, Phil. You just do a quick keyword search. You can do it on a smartphone or a desktop computer or anything like that. It's not hard to find the information at all.
Well, I realize that, but I just wanted people to be aware of it if they haven't heard about it.
Okay.
I just kind of wanted to get out it on the airways. Thank you.
I think that's a good idea. And, Phil, I appreciate our being the soapbox that you use to make that happen. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. By the way, if you believe in supporting American craftsmanship and veterans and independent talk radio, go to my website and pick up a limited edition Lars Larson Show challenge coin. Proudly made by American veterans, every one of those challenge coins comes with a personally signed thank you card, and all proceeds benefit veterans. Now, if you wonder, well, didn't you have those challenge coins before? Yeah. I've been a challenge coin collector because I began to get them from people who've served in the military, people in law enforcement, and other. In fact, I've got Donald Trump's first challenge coin, and he told me that I was the first person who actually received one. So what happened to the challenge coins we used to have? They were made by a veterans group in Georgia back when we first started making the challenge coins for this show. And then that veterans group went out of existence. We don't even know why. We just know that one day we stopped hearing from them. But making those challenge coins and selling them benefited the veterans group. It does not bring any benefit to us other than the fact that if people say, hey, I'd like to have something connected to the show, the challenge coin is available. You can find it on our website. And by the way, all the proceeds go to the veterans groups that actually make the challenge coins. Not a single dime goes to me or goes to members of my staff. So you can find it at LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X today, would you buy a home in a neighborhood where the HOA tracks every car coming and going? Today's X poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101.